and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 2nd. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We will start off with just a brief look at the weather. Today it's going to be sunny and windy with a high of 58, a low of 41. Tomorrow mostly sunny with a high of 72 and a low of 43. And Sunday, Easter Sunday, my goodness, mostly sunny and windy, but a high of 75 and a low of 54. You wonder how that fits in. Our normal highs and lows are 58 for the high and 35 for the low, except in 1981 there was a record high of 84, and in 2018 there was a record low of 15 on this day. Before we get into the news in earnest, just want to let you know that the Gazette has included a lot of articles from across the state, so we're going to go on a little bit of a virtual trip today as we look at news throughout the state. But we do have some local articles here, the first of which is on the Gazette's front page, titled Fired Up Republicans Rally Cedar Rapids Crowd. And this is written by James Q. Lynch out of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Jeff Kaufman nearly hugged U.S. Senator Rick Scott on stage in front of an audience and C-SPAN cameras. Maybe on your second visit, the Republican Party of Iowa chairman told the head of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, who had endorsed Iowa's leadoff role every 4 years in the presidential nomination process. It's worked. Why would you change it? The Florida senator said when Kaufman asked him about Iowa's precinct caucuses. That first-in-the-nation status is often challenged, and this year the Democratic National Committee is looking at changes that could knock Iowa off that first-in-the-nation perch. Scott said he didn't see a need for tinkering with the nomination calendar. He said every state is unique. What you have works for Iowa, and it works for the country. It's helped give us really good candidates. That didn't work for Democrats in 2020, when the party's complex counting process and faulty technology fouled up the results for weeks. But the focus Thursday night was not on the past, but on Republican victories and the future. Scott said he believes President Joe Biden, who took office 10 weeks ago, won't be reelected because, if you look at where we are, the Biden agenda is unpopular. GOP polls show Americans favor secure borders, 70+% want children back in school, and they disagree with the president's decision to shut down the Keystone XL pipeline. Scott said, "They want us to stop all of the crazy spending, stop all of the bad ideas. I actually believe if we all are vocal about this, we'll stop this stuff. The public is on our side. We need to talk to them," end quote. Rather than spend time on the mall, little fights we get into, everything Republicans are saying, writing, and posting on social media should be tied to 2022, Kaufman said. He also said, "We don't care how the deck chairs on the Titanic are arranged. We want to steer away from the iceberg." According to Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, the iceberg is the absolute madness coming from the left. Scott was in Cedar Rapids to help raise money for Ernst, who won re-election in November for a second term representing Iowa. She was on the same page as Scott. "The next 2 years will be pivotal for Republicans," she told a few hundred people at the Elmcrest Country Club, echoing Scott's optimism about winning back control of the Senate. She said, "This is doable. We've got to keep the faith. Stay steady. Stay strong. Stay with us." In 2022, in the Senate, there will be 20 GOP seats and 14 Democratic seats on the ballot. Winning back the majority will be a tall order, Scott said, but Republicans, independents, and some Democrats are fed up. The job could be easier with U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley on the ticket. The seven-term Butler County Republican is being coy about his plans. Grassley, age 87, who has repeatedly said that if his health is good, he will run again, plans to announce his decision this summer or fall. If he runs, he will have a GOP primary opponent. If he doesn't run, both the GOP and Democratic fields of primary candidates are expected to be large, as open U.S. Senate seats have been rare in Iowa. Out of respect to the senior senator, Ernst said she doesn't ask him about his reelection plans, but that doesn't stop Scott from asking Grassley every time he sees him whether he's raising money for the campaign and whether he has announced he's running. Scott said Senator Grassley has been there long enough to know his way around. He needs to stay there. That sentiment wasn't shared by a handful of sign-waving members of Indivisible Iowa, who greeted Republicans as they arrived at the Elmcrest Country Club for the fundraiser. Typical signs said, "Hinson's a hypocrite," and "Hinson and Ernst voted against the American Rescue Plan," referring to 1st District Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. Elwood Garlock of Cedar Rapids said, "We need people in Congress who will represent the people, not the big money." The same goes for Grassley and other Iowa Republicans in Congress. Their votes don't represent us. Inside, the atmosphere was upbeat, especially when 2nd District Representative Marionette Miller Meeks of Ottumwa arrived. Her opponent, Democrat Rita Hart of Wheatland, this week withdrew her petition asking the House to overturn the narrow results. Hart claimed 22 legally cast ballots were not counted in the race. Miller Meeks' perseverance is proof, Kaufman said, that Iowans can't be bought and won't be bullied. Miller Meeks became emotional as she thanked supporters and talked about the challenge she has faced over the past 4 months. "We were in a staring contest with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She blinked," Miller Meeks said. "Iowa Republicans are fired up and energized, Kaufman said, saying, "Not just an energy of defense, this federal nonsense. It's the energy of a positive party, a party that is going to have a better 2022. And that starts today," added former Speaker of the Iowa House Linda Uppmeyer of Clear Lake, saying, "Take a piece of that energy home with you tonight." Hinson of Marion was a, quote, "special guest." Her defeat of a Democratic incumbent in the 20-county Northeast Iowa district that includes Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, and Dubuque was another of the GOP highlights in November. It wasn't a completely one-sided affair. Led by Senator Dan Zumbach, Republican of Ryan, the crowd prayed for Biden, asking that he be blessed with the passion of Senator Joni Ernst, the tenacity of Miller Meeks, and the desire to serve of Hinson, and help the president to see the light of the American people because his light has been dimmed, end quote, and the end of the article. Also on the Gazette's front page, this article from Marissa Payne, "Cedar Rapids prepares for first pedestrian underpass." A bridge that for 40 years let pedestrians cross over First Avenue East traffic below is being replaced by the city's first ever pedestrian underpass. Wednesday night, the city temporarily closed First Avenue East at 27th Street so crews could remove the pedestrian bridge, which was damaged in the August 10th derecho. The bridge and its stairs were not compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act, which became law 9 years after the bridge was built in 1981. The demolition is part of First Avenue East road work already scheduled this year at the intersection with 27th Street. The northeast quadrant on one side of the avenue and the southeast quadrant on the other. The overall First Avenue East project includes several pedestrian safety enhancements, such as new pedestrian-friendly traffic signals at 27th, 29th, and 32nd Streets, sidewalk repairs, ADA-compliant sidewalk ramps at all intersections, and a new pedestrian path under First Avenue East between 29th and 32nd Streets, which will be both LED lighted and ADA-compliant. Although this is the city's first pedestrian underpass, city engineer Brenna Fall said another one is being designed for an extension of the Lindale Trail across Blair's Ferry Road Northeast near C Avenue Northeast. Fall said, "Underpasses are an efficient, safe, and ADA-compliant design for trail crossings at high volume or high-speed roadways. The underpass is a component of the CMAR trail system," Fall said. The city is using federal surface transportation block grant funding allocated by the Corridor Metropolitan Planning Organization for the trail and roadway work. The city also is matching funds for the grant. The trail and underpass total $4.9 million of the $11.8 million First Avenue East project. Moving to the Iowa Today section, first from Gage Miskimen of the Gazette, "Marion Chamber leaving City Hall." The Marion Chamber of Commerce will be moving out of City Hall this spring to a historic building just a couple of blocks away. The move to the Lillis and Wilson building at 1070 7th Avenue will further the organization's mission and create a visible presence in the historic Main Street district, a news release said that was released on Thursday. The new office's 2,800 square feet will provide conference rooms for meetings and programming, and a business hospitality area for members to stop in for coffee. The chamber hopes to be fully moved in by June. The chamber has been in City Hall, 1225 6th Avenue, since 2006, and before that was on 11th Street. Chamber President Jill Ackerman said, "It's no secret that Marion is growing. This move positions the chamber to better serve our membership and prepare for future growth," end quote. The new office will help tourism initiatives move forward, including those for the Prospect Meadows Baseball Complex on Highway 13 and County Home Road, the news release said. It will offer a concierge center to welcome visitors and provide information to city residents. Before moving on to the daily COVID report, here's an article from Gage Miskimen also, titled, "Lyndale Mall May Be Mass Vaccination Site." Linn County is considering offering a mass vaccination clinic at Lyndale Mall if enough vaccines become available. Linn County supervisors agreed Wednesday to sign a certificate of insurance as part of an agreement with the mall. The certificate will allow Linn County Public Health to use space in the mall for a vaccination clinic at a time and date yet to be determined. The health department is in the planning phase for a mass vaccination clinic, but that will depend in part on the amount of vaccine allocated to the county, Linn County Communications Director Joy Alexander said Thursday. Alexander said essentially, what public health staff is doing now is proactively planning for a mass clinic by securing a location and resources so they are prepared for when and if Linn County receives enough vaccine to be able to offer a mass clinic. Logistics, cost, supplies, and staffing enter into the plan. However, the primary reason for not doing larger clinics is due to vaccine supply and the robust capacity of our local vaccine providers, according to a statement on the Public Health Department's website. The county now is allocating the vaccines to local health care providers and pharmacies and is holding smaller clinics for targeted populations. The statement reads, "While the current amount of vaccine Linn County is receiving, this strategy is working efficiently. The model we have used for clinics for targeted populations has helped us prepare for larger scale public clinics." As of Thursday afternoon, 113,446 vaccine doses had been administered in Linn County, with 45,368 county residents fully vaccinated, just over 25% of the county's adult population. The state Monday is opening vaccines to all Iowans 16 and older as supplies allow. This Saturday, state officials and Hy-Vee are offering a mass vaccination site in Des Moines for adults 65 or older and adults with underlying health conditions at the Community Choice Credit Union Convention Center. The clinic will have around 3,500 doses of vaccine to administer. Looking at the COVID report, Gage Miskimen has written this article, "Iowa reports 809 new virus cases, 8 deaths." Iowa on Thursday reported 809 new COVID-19 cases and 8 new confirmed deaths. The new numbers bring the state totals to 351,650 cases and 5,751 deaths since last March, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The 7-day average for new cases in Iowa is 564. The new cases come from 16,546 tests in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Thursday for a reported positivity rate of 5.51%. Linn County on Thursday reported 51 cases identified in 801 tests for a 1-day positivity rate as reported of 6.37%. The highest positivity rate since February 21st. The county's 7-day average for new cases is 18. Johnson County added 31 cases as of 11 a.m. Thursday, with a 7-day new case average of 24. As of Thursday afternoon, 591,966 Iowans were fully vaccinated, an increase of more than 14,000 from Wednesday's reported total. That's 18.76% of all Iowans and 23.59% of all adult Iowans. To date, 1,551,293 doses of vaccine have been administered in the state, up more than 35,000 from Wednesday, with 1.5 5 million going to Iowans. The total number of people fully vaccinated in the state is 616,065. We talked earlier about vaccination totals in Linn County, but in Johnson County, 91,565 doses have been administered, and 35,897 county residents are fully vaccinated. That is 28.88% of the adult population and 23.75% of the total population. The 8 deaths reported Thursday occurred between February 12th and March 23rd. Of that, 2 were age 81 and over, 5 between 61 and 80, and 1 was between 41 and 60. Wapello County reported 2 deaths. Counties reporting 1 death each were Bremer, Marion, Montgomery, Pocahontas, Scott, and Woodbury. Across the state, hospitalizations inched up from 191 to 194. Patients in ICU increased from 38 to 41. And patients on ventilators increased from 11 to 15. For long-term care on Thursday, 2 long-term care facilities were still reporting COVID-19 outbreaks, which is 3 or more cases among residents and staff, with 17 individuals ill. And as of Thursday, 2,240 individuals have died in Iowa's care facilities, an increase of 5 from Wednesday. I find in the North Liberty Leader, a weekly publication, an article. I don't know if the Gazette has covered it before, but may bear repeating if it has. This is not attributed to an author, but it's titled Field to Family Online Farmers Market Season Begins April 27th. Iowa City area shoppers are able to shop local food and farm products online with contact-free pickup again in 2021 via Field to Family's online farmers market. The online farmers market season begins at noon on April 27th, when online ordering for the first market opens. The first drive-through pickup date is Saturday, May 1st at the Johnson County Health and Human Services parking ramp on Clinton Street in Iowa City. Field to Family's director, Michelle Kenyon, said as an educational nonprofit, the online market provides an additional avenue for us to share food system education, encourage deeper connections to local growers, and promote healthy local foods. Field to Family is offering the online farmers market for a second season in response to demand from vendors and customers. The Iowa City-based nonprofit intends to enhance access to local foods by creating an additional opportunity for consumers and producers to connect during a difficult time. Customers are able to place online orders between noon Tuesday and noon Wednesday each week through October. Customers drive through the HHS parking ramp during a selected 30-minute pickup window to receive their order on Saturday mornings. So far, 31 vendors enrolled in the virtual markets, offering plant starts, produce, meat, dairy, and value-added food products. Field to Family welcomes new vendors as well. Those interested should reach out to Ben at fieldtofamily.org to inquire. Field to Family partnered with the City of Iowa City to offer the first ever online farmers market season in 2020 in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, Field to Family's online market is independent from any other farmers markets in the area. More information for vendors, customers, and supporters is available at www.fieldtofamily.org and then online farmers market. Iowa City-based nonprofit Field to Family works to create a more local, healthy, and sustainable regional food system in eastern Iowa. Community support, in particular from the City of Iowa City and Johnson County Board of Supervisors, helps make Field to Family's work possible. And here's one of those, not necessarily local, but still Iowa-based articles I mentioned at the start of our broadcast. No release for gun enthusiast arrested in Iowa. This is out of the Associated Press, but does have an Iowa connection, obviously. A judge ordered the detention of a Colorado firearms enthusiast who raised alarm at an Iowa gun store last week when he said he was surprised people didn't suspect he was the Boulder mass shooter. Adam Vinoy, age 40, attempted to buy guns in Iowa after he was released on bond from a jail in Nebraska, where troopers had seized several firearms and marijuana from his vehicle during a March 14th traffic stop, according to U.S. Magistrate Stephen Jackson. A firearms dealer in Ankeny refused to sell Vinoy an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle and alerted the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives after Vinoy said he was surprised friends hadn't called to ask whether he was responsible for the shooting in which 10 people were killed at a Boulder grocery store. After he was unable to secure a firearm, Vinoy purchased, quote, kits that would enable him to assemble firearms, end quote, the judge said in his ruling Wednesday. Video posted by Vinoy to his Instagram account showed that he spent nearly $3,000 buying firearms accessories at Brownells, a retailer in Grinnell. The judge wrote after a detention hearing earlier on Wednesday, this continued attempt to obtain weapons, coupled with the behavior described at the hearing, leads to the conclusion that the government has met its burden and detention is appropriate. The judge ordered federal authorities to transfer Vinoy to Nebraska, where he is charged in federal court with possessing a firearm as an unlawful drug user. The Nebraska State Patrol initially arrested Vinoy on March 14th on I-80 in Lancaster County after a driver had called police to report he was driving recklessly at about 120 miles an hour. During a search of his packed truck, troopers seized a handgun from Vinoy's jacket, a loaded AR-style semi-automatic rifle with an illegal silencer, four other firearms, ammunition, a bulletproof blanket and vest, two brown wigs, and an Air Force costume. They also found marijuana. Vinoy said his truck was packed with all his belongings because he was abruptly leaving Colorado. Records show he told a Nebraska trooper during the stop that he was leaving Denver because his neighbors didn't like him, he had a mental breakdown, and quit his job. He told the trooper he would use his time in jail to, quote, think about getting even with people, end quote, a remark the trooper viewed as threatening. They jailed the Denver man on weapons and drug charges. He was released after posting $5,000 bond on March 17th, even though he threatened to kill a guard, exposed his penis to guards, and threw feces from his cell into a common area, according to a federal complaint unsealed last Friday. We'll move to the Insight page now, and the first article or column is Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column. And this one is titled, It Was Never Really About the 22 Votes. The historic election challenge in Iowa's 2nd District has come to the underwhelming conclusion everyone saw coming. Last November, U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks won the nation's closest congressional race in nearly half a century. After state recounts confirmed Miller Meeks' 6-vote victory, opponent Rita Hart appealed the result to her fellow Democrats in the U.S. House. Hart this week withdrew her challenge. With just an 8-member advantage in the House, it was clear there was not enough support among Democrats in Congress to reverse the results. Overturning state-certified election results is unpopular, and Democrats in tough districts were not eager to cast a vote on the matter. The process Hart initiated was political, not legal. It depended less on the facts than on the whims of elected representatives. Like with impeachment, partisans slip in and out of legalese when it suits them, but all that really matters is whether you have the votes. Hart chose the politicized route controlled by members of her own party, rather than a separate process prescribed by Iowa law, and she still was on track to lose again. And even as she bowed out, Hart clung to her theory of a botched election, writing in her announcement on Wednesday, I am saddened that some Iowans' votes will not count through no fault of their own. It is a stain on our democracy that the truth has not prevailed, end quote. Hart's challenge hinged on 22 ballots, which her campaign says wrongly went uncounted and would have swung the election in her favor. Iowa Democrats' public relations campaign dubbed them the Uncounted 22. In a slew of letters to Eastern Iowa newspapers, Hart's supporters variously called to count the 22 ballots or to count all the votes. Those are not necessarily the same thing. The ballots identified by heart were excluded from the official results due to, quote, errors by state and county officials, Hart claimed, such as mishandled curbside ballots or rejected provisional ballots. But those are only the ballots the Hart team identified and publicly disclosed. It's likely there are other votes that were discounted for similar reasons. Counting all the votes would have required a much broader accounting than the 22 ballots cherry-picked by one candidate. Miller Meek's lawyers wrote in a filing in January, Hart makes no showing that these 22 ballots are the only ones where elections officials made ordinary decisions applying Iowa election law. Elections are messy. That's why we have systems in place to verify results and recount ballots in narrow contests. In Iowa, the system includes bipartisan recount boards in each county as part of a process both campaigns agreed to. To be clear, Hart's maneuver was legal and constitutional, nothing like Donald Trump's deadly fantasy about overturning last year's legitimate presidential election results. But appealing the second district results to a partisan legislature, nevertheless, was a bad idea, helping to seed distrust in our elections. Mr. Sullivan concludes, fallout from the 2020 elections helped cement the norm of election disputes. That's good news for attorneys at fancy law firms and political fundraisers who cash in on drawn-out contests. It's bad news for Iowa voters. Now it's time for the Gazette's editorial today, which is under the heading A Legislative Failure. State lawmakers in Iowa are considering a trio of bills this session collectively labeled Back the Blue by supporters. What's disappointing is that lawmakers didn't go back to last summer when they approved a bipartisan package of policing reforms amid protests over the death of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minneapolis. When Governor Kim Reynolds signed the bill, it was hailed as only a start. With that victory and a gubernatorial task force also working on justice reforms, hopes were raised that more progress would be made in the 2021 session. That didn't happen. Republican lawmakers scrapped a bill proposed by Reynolds that would prohibit law enforcement from using racial profiling. They instead embraced her Back the Blue proposals. Senate File 534 expands and toughens penalties for crimes such as criminal mischief, disorderly conduct, harassment, and unlawful assembly. It's aimed directly at Black Lives Matter protests that occurred in Iowa cities last summer. Senate File 479 would take state funds away from cities that cut police budgets. No Iowa community is considering defunding police, but the bill could discourage efforts to change the focus of policing at the local level. Senate File 476 would provide law enforcement personnel with broad immunity from lawsuits resulting from the use of force. Opponents contend the bill's definition of, quote, qualified immunity, end quote, is too expansive. Whether you support or oppose these bills, it's what's missing that represents a legislative failure. The fruitful dialogue between young social justice advocates, Black community leaders, lawmakers from both parties, and the governor to target systemic racism in the justice system has vanished. Bipartisanship and vows to do more have faded away. Instead, GOP lawmakers have decided to make this yet another divisive us-versus-them issue. And they're resorting to the same old formula of tough-on-crime legislation that has led to a justice system plagued by flaws and inequities. The nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency concludes that due to current racial disparities in the justice system, the crimes and penalties expanded in Iowa, Senate File 534 will disproportionately affect Black Iowans. We already have crimes and protections on the books that, quote, back the blue. Nobody wants police officers to be harmed. But tilting the balance between state power and protest further toward the powerful is not going to make protesters stay home. It's going to intensify the anger and frustration driving them to the streets. That's where they know their voices can be heard, because at the state house, leaders are no longer listening. And again, that's the Gazette's editorial. And finally, from the Insight page, this community letter that is from Jared Klein of Cedar Rapids. Mr. Klein writes about climate change and says, recent events in Texas highlight the dangers of climate change. We think more about the heat than the cold when we think of global warming. However, a warming world weakens the jet streams that keep the polar vortex in place over the Arctic. And when that happens, ironically, Global warming causes cold so severe it cuts off electricity to millions and bursts enough pipes to create a humanitarian crisis in the world's richest nation. Climate change is expensive this way. According to Datu research, a moderate increase in greenhouse gases is likely to result in an increase of 45% to 87% in the frequency of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin by the century's end. It's unlikely Iowans will be able to avoid helping to pay for that damage. We're also going to see a significant increase in flooding worldwide, and in Midwestern storms in particular. Every 1 degree Celsius of global warming is likely to damage our GDP by more than $250 billion and increase the number of American dreams flooded or frozen to death. Mr. Klein writes, it would be both fiscally irresponsible and physically dangerous not to take action. One of the simplest and most equitable ways for Americans to work together across party lines against climate change is a carbon fee and dividend. This policy collects money from polluters and gives it back to the taxpayers affected by that pollution. For more information, Mr. Klein suggests visiting energyinnovationact.org. A reminder that you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 2nd. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. We have three short notices and two a little bit longer obituaries. First, from Belle Plain, John Eugene Papish, also known as Masher, age 67, died yesterday, and the arrangements are being held through Rayback Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plain. From Manchester, Sherry Ray Fisher, age 79, died Wednesday, March 31st. Her arrangements are being made through Leonard Muller Funeral Home and Crematory in Manchester. And from Raleigh, Leo D. Kress, age 93, died Monday, March 29th. The family's being assisted by White Funeral Home in Independence. Moving to the longer obituaries, Willa Ray O'Connor, age 87, of Hiawatha, passed away Wednesday, March 31st at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. next Friday, April 9th, at St. Pius X Catholic Church. A private family interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Following the continued guidance from health officials, physical distancing must be practiced and the use of face masks or shields is required. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be sent to the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Our only other obituary today is for Clara May Eves, age 97, of Tipton, who died yesterday while under the care of hospice at Prairie Hills Assisted Living in Tipton. On Saturday, tomorrow, April 3rd, Fry Funeral Home will host a visitation at noon, followed by a funeral service at 1 p.m. Clara will be laid to rest at the Tipton Masonic Cemetery at 2 p.m. In her memory, a memorial fund has been established for the Tipton's Cedar County Senior Dining Center. There is a single prep sports article today in the Gazette, and it is about track, and it's titled Kennedy Topping Charts, and it's written by Jeff Linder. You knew Drew Bartels was a fast kid. Here's what you didn't know. Kingston Stadium now has a fast track. Bartels, a senior at Cedar Rapids, Kennedy said, oh, it's fast. Yes, it's fast. Once it gets warm, you're really going to see some fast times here. Bartels won three events, the long jump and 110-meter hurdles, plus the shuttle hurdle relay at the Washington Invitational Boys Track and Field Meet last night at Kingston Stadium. His effort in the 110 highs, 14.35 seconds, vaulted him to number one in the state in all classes. Kennedy's all-senior shuttle, which consisted of Reed Packbier, Bartels, Max White, and Brody Lavelle, that's number one now too, after a 58.99 second effort. Bartle said, I love those guys. I grew up with them. We always said when we're seniors, it's going to be our shuttle. Cedar Rapids Prairie had the deepest squad in the 11-team field, edging Cedar Falls 144-141 for the team title. Kennedy was third with 104 points. Of course, there was no high school track and field season in 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There was, however, an all-comers meet in July at BGM High School, sponsored by Drake Relay's public address announcer Mike J. And Bartles was one of the stars there, winning the long jump and the 400 hurdles. Bartles said, "I wanted this first meet to me one to remember. I didn't want to be close to anybody else." Bartles will continue his career next year at the University of Northern Iowa. He soared 22-2 in the long jump, 4 inches less than his season best, which ranks second statewide. The Kingston track was resurfaced and expanded to 8 lanes in the summer of 2019, then sat vacant last spring. Times were surprisingly fast on the oval Thursday. Iowa City Liberty's Jack Kinzer, the 800-meter champion, said, "I like the surface a lot. It feels pretty springy. It's a lot better than 2 years ago." Kinzer ran on Liberty's 3,200-meter relay, which finished second to Cedar Falls. Both teams sizzled for early April. The Tigers finished in 7:55.04, the Lightning in 7:58.19. Kinzer said, "I'm ecstatic. I knew Cedar Falls was really good. We stayed as close as we could. Our goal was to go for the Drake Relay's blue standard of 8:05, and we killed it." Prairie claimed the team title despite winning just 2 events, compared to 7 for Cedar Falls. Siondae Adams struck gold in the 100 at 11:54, and the sprint medley relay won in 1:38.13. Moving to the Gazette's Business 380 section, this article from the Associated Press titled, "Judge Says No to Pork Plants Speeding Production." Dateline Omaha. A federal judge has thrown out a rule allowing pork plants to speed up production lines because the U.S. Department of Agriculture didn't properly consider the risks to workers. The judge in Minnesota ruled Wednesday that the agency's Food Safety and Inspection Service didn't follow proper procedures before then-President Donald Trump's administration issued the rule in 2019. The lawsuit was filed by the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, along with local unions in Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, and Oklahoma, and the not-for-profit consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. U.S. District Judge Joan Erickson said the agency, quote, "expressly identified worker safety as an important consideration and requested public comment on whether increasing line speeds would harm workers." Then, after receiving many comments raising worker safety concerns, FSIS rejected the comments and eliminated line speed limits without considering worker safety, end quote. The USDA said Thursday that the agency is reviewing the ruling and it remains deeply committed to worker safety and a safe, reliable food supply. Union officials praised the ruling because they say faster line speeds at pork plants increase the risk of knife injuries, knee, back, shoulder, and neck traumas, and repetitive motion injuries for workers. The judge said her ruling won't take effect for 90 days to allow regulators time to determine how the change will affect plants that already switched to faster line speeds. Also from that Business 380 section, for this unemployment report by John Stepp, titled "Iowa Claims Rise for First Time Since February." Iowa saw an increase in weekly unemployment claims during the week of March 20th for the first time since February. New claims decreased from 5,129 to 4,846, but continuing claims rose from 37,540 to 40,186, according to Iowa Workforce Development. About 48% of claims were related to coronavirus, up from 42.9% the previous week. Self-employed and independent contractors had the largest portion of claims with 988, followed by manufacturing with 793, construction with 400, retail trade with 377, and accommodation and food services with 359. In Linn County, manufacturing was the largest source of claims with 174, more than twice as many as in any other industry. The claims resulted in $22.4 million in federal pandemic unemployment compensation, $13.3 million in standard unemployment benefits, $9.8 million in pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, and $3.4 million in pandemic unemployment assistance. These numbers are preliminary and are yet to be adjusted by the U.S. Department of Labor. Moving to the living section, we have Brian Bush's column, A State of Mind, titled Time to Change Attitudes About Mental Illness. I do want to issue a disclaimer that's at the end of this column. It says, Brian Bush is a licensed mental health counselor in Cedar Rapids. He also works at Folliance, the parent company of the Gazette. Mr. Bush writes, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, one in five adults and one in six youth in America experience mental illness each year. It has become commonplace in today's news cycles to hear about tragedies that can be attributed at least in part to a mental health crisis. It also is common to hear about the stigma surrounding mental illness. So how do we collectively break through that stigma and support individuals and communities experiencing mental health concerns? When it comes to physical health, there is a common understanding that exercising, eating healthy, and keeping up with regular doctor visits can help maintain positive health. Symptoms, illnesses, and disease are comfortably part of the conversation. So, while we know that a healthy diet is always important, we also acknowledge that much more than that is needed to help someone suffering from anything from a sore throat to cancer. A support system is embedded in our collective consciousness when it comes to doing things necessary to address issues when something goes wrong. When it comes to mental health, we are generally comfortable discussing concepts like self-care and mindfulness that can help maintain positive health. We are comfortable, if not self-righteous, to look back and reflect and be appalled as we question what went wrong when our system fails and tragedy occurs. But what about everything in between? This would be similar to promoting the benefits of exercising while ignoring symptoms like high blood pressure and obesity and being shocked at continually increasing rates of heart disease. We aren't yet comfortable and certainly not collectively willing to have the necessary and often difficult conversations around people struggling with mental health issues. Too often, we leave the true realities of living with mental illness out of the conversation entirely. Symptoms like intense fear or worry, extreme mood changes, withdrawal, avoidance, changes in energy or sleeping habits, or self-harming. Conditions like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and eating disorders, the list goes on. Practicing self-care is always important, but more must be done, and therefore talked about openly for those experiencing mental illness. Unfortunately, throughout history, people with mental illness have been branded, ostracized, and locked away. As a result, many people still irrationally and inaccurately assume mental illness equates to being unreliable and unstable. This stigma leads to a reluctance to seek help, a lack of understanding and compassion, and numerous challenges for those facing the pressures mental illness brings. But just like physical ailments are not moral indicators, neither are mental health concerns. There is no single cause of mental illness, whether biological or circumstantial. Mental illness is not an ethical failure any more than is physical illness. Equally important, just as talking openly about physical illness allows individuals to feel secure in seeking treatment, we must collectively make an effort to broaden the dialogue around mental illness. That begins with each of us making the conscious decision and effort to listen, learn, and refrain from judging. Of the nearly 60 million Americans experiencing mental illness, less than half receive treatment. The individuals experiencing challenge may be family members, friends, colleagues, kids, and maybe even you. To create a system where each individual is allowed and encouraged to feel safe and comfortable seeking help, it will take all of us committing to break the stigma and join the raw and honest dialogue. And this is by Brian Bush, who's a licensed mental health counselor in Cedar Rapids, also working at Folliant, the parent company of the Gazette. I'm going to reach out to the North Liberty Leader again today for another article that may be of interest to you. This is titled Iowa DNR to Begin Spring Burning. Dateline Swisher. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, is conducting prescribed burns this spring on wildlife management areas managed by the Iowa DNR's Iowa River Wildlife Unit in Lynn, Johnson, Benton, Iowa, Tama, Cedar, and Mahaska counties. Areas scheduled for prescribed burns are Iowa River Corridor in Benton, Tama, and Iowa County, Spring Grove, Union Grove, Conch and West Salt Creek in Tama County, Hawthorne Lake in Mahaska County, Hawkeye Wildlife Area, Red Bird in Johnson County, Mink Run in Cedar County, Chain o' Lakes in Lynn County, and Dudgeon Lake in Benton County. Prescribed burns are used to improve wildlife habitat, control invasive plant species, restore and maintain native plant communities, and reduce wildlife potential and vary in size from a few acres to several hundred acres. Areas are typically burned every 1 to 5 years. Prescribed burns typically begin mid to late morning and are completed by late afternoon or early evening between late March and late May. Burns will be conducted on a day that meets the objectives and weather conditions defined in the burn plan. Any prescribed burns that are not able to be completed this spring will be considered for the burn schedule next fall. You can contact DNR wildlife biologist Stephen Woodruff with any questions or concerns regarding burns in these counties. His number is 319-330-7013. That's 7013. The Gazette has included an article republished from the Quad City Times by Tom Lowy, Dateline DeWitt, and it is titled Strangers Share Sorrow Over 10-Year-Old's Death. What kind of world do we live in? An answer to that question comes Wednesday evening on the shores of a small pond 3 miles north of DeWitt. It was delivered by a little brown-eyed girl in a too-big hoodie who carried a single yellow rose, followed by her mother and her mother's friend. 7-year-old Avery scrambled down an embankment where she found a pink teddy bear, a bright orange basketball, and 3 Mylar balloons that marked the place where the remains of Brescia Terrell were found March 22nd by a pair of fishermen. Brescia of Davenport was 10 when she disappeared the night of July 9th or early July 10th last year. After almost 9 months of searching and waiting and hoping, Davenport police announced Wednesday an autopsy had determined the remains were those of Brescia. Avery said she wanted Brescia to know people were thinking about her. Shayla Hippler, Avery's mother, said, "We haven't told Avery everything, but she knew a girl was found, and she wanted to come with us to leave something in this place. We live in DeWitt. We don't know this girl or her family, but we wanted to show we cared." Hippler wiped away tears, and her friend Brooke Warwick tried to explain. Warwick said, "Everyone around here is shaken up. I've grown up here and lived here my entire life. I think a lot of people feel really bad for Brescia and really bad for her family. What can we do? We can come here and offer some sign of support, some sign that we care, even though we'll never know Brescia's family." Hippler pulled her daughter close and offered another thought, saying, "We live in a sad world." Catherine Schott and Jordan Manning made the 30-minute drive from Davenport to scatter red rose petals around the makeshift memorial. A 35-year-old woman who lives across Highway 61 and a few miles from the pond brought a bouquet of wildflowers. She didn't want to give her name, but she wanted to leave something behind, and said, "I drive by this place every single day. I don't know how long Brescia was here, but it's heart-wrenching to think we never saw her. I just want Brescia's family to know we are thinking of them." Margaret Zimmerman, a nurse, lives on a farm in nearby Maquoketa. She, too, frequently drives the yellow dirt road that passes the pond. She brought an array of purple flowers for the girl she never met. Zimmerman said, "My heart just sank when I heard they found a body. I think most of us knew it was Brescia. We didn't want it to be her, But that's a hard thing, too, because it's going to be someone's child, someone who was loved and missed. Zimmerman recalled something she heard just after Wednesday's announcement, saying, "Someone said Davenport lost a daughter. That's true. But I'll tell you, Eastern Iowa lost a daughter. I'm a nurse, and I travel for work. I've seen Brescia posters in places like Waterloo and Des Moines and Dubuque. I even saw a poster in southern Wisconsin." The sun was setting by the time Zimmerman left the pond. The space between the distant horizon and dark encroaching clouds burned orange. None of the people who came to the pond Wednesday knew who'd left behind the teddy bear, the basketball, or the balloons, but they knew that, yes, the world can be sad, and that, yes, sorrow can be shared. We'll end today with excerpts from a North Liberty Leader article by Chris Umscheid, titled "Little League Ball is Alive and Well in Oxford, Bringing Back a Small Town Tradition." Dateline is Oxford. Little League baseball is a long-standing American tradition in towns large and small, and has been a summertime standard in Oxford since 1973. However, the pandemic wiped out the Little League season last year, and a number of factors led to the disintegration of the program earlier this year, but a group of Oxford residents have banded together to rebuild the league. Gina Hedgewald, one of the new band of organizers, said it was hard getting the season started again. What do we do? What is acceptable? Are kids going to want to play? Are they going to want to play in masks? The current committee, they all had older kids aged out of the league, so they've served their time, they've done a great job, and they were ready to pass the torch on to someone else. Hedgewald, Shelby White, and Mary Trimpe are among the someone else's working to make a Little League season happen this spring. Hedgewald said they found a great need for kids who aren't able to join travel teams and a desire in the community to keep the tradition alive. According to research done by Trimpe, Mildred Tomash owned the field, which previously was home to a brickyard and is now home to the Little League Diamonds and the Clear Creek Amana Softball Diamond. Over the years, several improvements were made, including erecting two shelters, a restroom building, a concession stand, and an equipment shed. Ownership of the park was transferred to Clear Creek Amana Youth Little League in 2018, and Trimpe noted much has been done in the upkeep of the property, including fixing drainage issues, with more to be done in the coming years. Hedgewald said the goal for this year is just to get a season going, get kids out on the field playing, and then we're really ambitious moving forward. We really want to revitalize the league, maybe even reach out and do tournaments with some neighboring towns toward the end of the season. I think what we're really seeing is, especially with the older kids, they want to be competitive. They want to play. They want to win. And I feel that's something the rec leagues kind of got away from a few years ago with not keeping score and things like that. And I think that's when we started to see a decline. White, who also played ball on the Oxford Diamonds, has coached her daughter Reagan, said many people seem to have all but given up on their 8 to 12-year-olds kids playing ball because they see travel ball as the only option. Convenience, competition, fundamentals, fun, and making memories are what the Little League program is all about. White said there's just so much nostalgia here. We spent our summers here. Between my older sister playing and me and Mom always helping with the concession stand and things like that, I want that for my kids. Although currently named the Clear Creek Amana Youth Little League, the program's not affiliated with Clear Creek Amana's Community School District and is in the process of changing its name to the Oxford Little League, with a new website debuting soon. The season will start the first week in May and wrap up in mid-June for younger teams and in late June for older teams. While the numbers are very good in the younger ages, the league does need more 5th, 6th, and 7th grade players. Practices will likely be once or twice per week ahead of games, which will be held during the week in the evenings. Among the tentative plans is an adult kickball tournament on Saturday, July 3rd, with an eye toward establishing an adult-only kickball league, and more details to follow on both. Hegwald ended by saying, "We really hope we can build up the program. We have a lot of plans for improvements here, and we're really excited." And Trimpe added, "Oxford is the place to play ball." And that does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April the 2nd. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.